Most important point. Do not settle for the status quo when the status quo is broken.
Bernie Sanders might be down, but his political revolution rolls on. Also today, a discussion about the lives of women in Saudi Arabia.
I have a piece of paper that says my son, again 23 years old, she's 44, is the legal guardian of me. It sounds stupid and silly, but it is the only way to make my every movement easier.
All that and much more coming up. And welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for March 17th, 2016. I'm Esther Averam here on 89.3 WPFW, Pacifica Radio in the nation's capital, where we are able to bring you coverage of social justice activists and activism. While on today's show, the U.S. presidential race continues to be the big story with violence at Donald Trump rallies, the continued corporate media snub of Bernie Sanders, and a very superficial discussion about what is political freedom of speech and what is proto-fascism. I'll speak to prolific author and activist Gerald Horn in the second half. But before that, we're honoring Women's History Month with two activists speaking on the particular plight and challenges of women in Saudi Arabia. And we'll also speak to our political commentator, Jamila Bey, on elections 2016. So as always, a lot packed into our less than an hour, starting with this week's headlines. In the aftermath of Hillary Clinton's apparent sweep of victories in this last Super Tuesday, the Bernie Sanders campaign insists to its supporters that there is still a path for their candidate to win the Democratic nomination. Quote, with more than half the delegates yet to be chosen and a calendar that favors us in the weeks and months to come, we remain confident that our campaign is on the path to win the nomination, Sanders told his supporters in an email yesterday. Meanwhile, Sanders supporters are protesting not only the lies told by Donald Trump on the campaign, but on the corporate media's continuing blackout of Sanders, who has racked up more than 800 delegates. On Tuesday night, all cable networks showed an empty podium waiting for Donald Trump to speak and gave time to all of the candidates remaining in the race, that is, except one candidate, Bernie Sanders. At the same time, he was delivering a major address to a packed, enthusiastic crowd in Arizona, where he hammered home his theme of wealth inequality in America as he moves on to focus on Midwestern and Western states.
Now, I want to give you one idea, one example of what a rigged economy is about. Turns out that the wealthiest family in this country is the Walton family of Walmart. Turns out that the wealthiest family in America who owns Walmart pay their workers wages that are so low that many of those workers have to go on Medicaid and food stamps in order to survive. And what a rigged economy is about is that the middle class taxpayer pays more in taxes to subsidize the employees of the wealthiest family in America. That's a rigged economy. So I say to the Walton family, the wealthiest family in America, get off of welfare, pay your workers a living wage.
In news from D.C., there are mixed reactions among progressives to President Obama's nomination of Judge Merrick Garland a former corporate lawyer who made his name for the prosecution of Oklahoma City bomber Timothy McVeigh. On the Ground contributor author John Jeter wrote yesterday, were Obama truly a progressive who found his noble policy ambitions thwarted by racist Republicans time and time again, he would have taken this opportunity with less than a year left in office and the GOP digging its own grave to appoint a truly liberal person of color. More on these issues in the second half. Also here in D.C., about 40 protesters gathered outside the USDA building in downtown Washington yesterday to protest the actions of LL Creations, which they say discriminates against African Americans and other ethnic groups. LL Creations is a federal contractor, and protesters affiliated with Unite Here Local 23 employed chants such as "Si se puede" as they marched in front of the building. Passersby showed support, and passing vehicles honked their horns in solidarity. The organizers of the event and those protesting hope that LL Creations and the USDA will stop discriminatory policies and institute a living wage. And today through 5 p.m., an important hearing on the city's plan to shut down D.C. General Family Shelter is being held at the Wilson Building, 14th and Pennsylvania Avenue. The Washington Interfaith Network, or WIN, has been organizing with D.C. General residents over the past 2 years in an aggressive push to shut down the dilapidated D.C. General Family Shelter, where there have been outbreaks of scabies, moldy rooms and hallways, and that have led children to go to the hospital. Also, vermin and poor food quality have been reported again and again by residents. At the hearing, the City Council will discuss the plan to shut down D.C. General Shelter and replace it with smaller short-term family housing in each ward. On the Ground contributor Lydia Curtis is at the hearing at the Wilson Building. She's also a volunteer with WIN, in full disclosure. Good morning, Lydia.
Good morning. How are you, Esther?
Okay, good. Thanks for joining me. So what's the turnout there? What's the scene at the hearing today?
Okay, well, it's a fantastic turnout. We're up in the fifth floor, room 500, and there are at least 150 people in there, and the overflow room on the fourth floor is full as well.
Okay, so who are the players? I'm on Facebook sometimes, and there's a slick advertising that keeps popping up in my thread opposing the Bowser plan, and some wards, and I think particularly Ward 5 and 1, have expressed particular concerns, but some social justice groups, such as WIN, are actually for it. So who are the factions forming up there?
Well, I know that the Coalition for Nonprofit Housing and Economic Development are for it, and they had a big rally last week.
Mm-hmm.
The campaign that you see is, I think it's the D.C. Residents for Responsible Government. We're not sure who they are. They're not very transparent, although one of their complaints is about transparency.
Okay.
The hearing for Bill 21620, the Homeward D.C. Omnibus Bill, hearing started at 10:48. The mayor is actually in there in the audience. Her deputy mayor, Donald, is there. The testimony hasn't started yet, but opening statements from the council persons has started. Grosso came out in support and Orange support, and then the more people will add on as the day unfolds.
Do organizations have any sense of whether the overall council is supportive of the bill?
They're mostly supportive. And there are 89 people on the witness list for today. Most of them are public witnesses, not representing an organization, but there are quite a few organizations on the list.
Okay, so what happens after today?
So after today, there will be design meetings in every ward, and if listeners want to get involved in that, they need to either reach out to their council person or to their ANC. And also, if you are a listener and you're supportive of the shelter plan, you need to also let your council person know, because they're under a lot of pressure.
Okay, so they won't be voting today?
They will not be voting until the middle of April.
Okay. Okay, so there may be more hearings, or...?
I'm guessing that there'll be at least one more.
Okay. Okay, well, we'll keep watch on this important issue. Thank you, Lydia.
Thank you.
Okay. Now, in planet news, a growing worldwide shift to renewable energy has played a critical role in stalling global carbon emissions, according to the International Energy Agency. Declining coal use in China and the United States, the world's two biggest emitters of carbon, and a surge in new renewable energy production were credited for driving that trend. Related to pollution, the World Health Organization has found in a new report that nearly a quarter of all deaths around the world are caused by living and working in toxic and polluted environments, and the worst affected are children, the poor, and the elderly. And the Obama administration is poised to ban offshore drilling in the Arctic and much of the Atlantic until 2022. The decision reverses course on President Obama's plan a year ago to sell oil and gas leases to fossil fuel companies to drill in waters off much of the southeastern Atlantic, a measure that led to widespread outcry from coastal communities. In Pennsylvania, a 10-person jury has handed down a $4.2 million verdict in vindication to two families who refused to settle in a case pitting homeowners in the village of Dimmock against a Houston-based fossil fuels company. After a two-week trial at the U.S. District Court in Scranton, the federal jury found that Cabot Oil and Gas Corporation, one of the largest gas fracking drillers in Pennsylvania, had polluted the family's well water. The verdict drew praise from anti-fracking activists, including filmmaker Josh Fox, who featured Dimmock's brown, odorous, and flammable water in his documentary Gasland, and told Greenwire that he was overjoyed by the news. And last in Planet News, a bill dubbed the Deny Americans the Right to Know DARK Act was defeated in the Senate yesterday. The legislation would have robbed consumers of the right to know which foods are genetically modified. Activists argued that, like consumers in 64 other countries, Americans have a right to know what's in our food and how it's grown. In Black Lives Matter news, the family of an African-American college student fatally shot by police in Pleasantville, New York in 2010 has reached a $6 million settlement with the village and the officer. DJ Henry was shot while driving away from a party. As Henry pulled away, authorities said the officer told him to stop and stepped in front of the car. Authorities found that Henry's car was braking when it struck the officer, Aaron Hess, who wound up on the hood and fired through the windshield, killing Henry. A number of witnesses said Hess jumped onto the hood of the car. And Jamela Bay is with me here in the studio right now to help wrap up the headlines, talking about the elections and its the connection with the Black Lives Matter movement. Good morning, Jamela.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me. It's always a delight to be with you, Esther. So, you know, every time I'm here, I feel like I come in and I don't know where to start the conversation. You know, we just had this past week Super Tuesday, a Supreme Court nominee. Marco, I am so thirsty. Maybe now I have time for a proper drink. Rubio dropping out of the GOP race for president. I mean, Fox News... Oh, man, maybe I need some of Marco's water. Fox News dumped a GOP debate because Donald Trump declined to take part. And then, you know what? Thanks, Obama. And I am certain it is the fault of POTUS. The cast from Hamilton, the musical, was just in town and they were supposed to do a live stream of songs from the show. But all we got was some stingy two song King George tariff tunes. You know, I'm sitting on my couch going, wait for it, wait for it. Esther, if I was not so hopeful that the stream would have come back, I'd have taken my tea and dumped it right into the Anacostia myself. Calmness, calmness. Anyway, the thoughts in my head are battling one another like skirmishes of the Revolutionary War. But I do want to point out, and you gave me a wonderful lead-in, I predict this is going to be a trend this election season. And this trend that we're starting to see is the Black Lives Matter voting bloc. In Cleveland, Cuyahoga County District Attorney Tim McGinty was handed a resounding defeat in his reelection bid Tuesday night. The smackdown heard round the country. It's been about 3 months that the calls to oust McGinty started. He is the prosecutor who many Cleveland residents and American residents say botched the handling of the Tamir Rice case. Rice, of course, that 12-year-old baby on a playground playing with a toy gun in a state with open carry laws, being shot within mere seconds of officers Timothy Lohman and Frank Garenbach arriving on the scene for a call of someone with a gun. McGinty is the prosecutor who recommended that no charges be filed against those officers. Right. You know, voters remembered that, too, and they acted in a way that made it clear they disagreed with McGuinty, who won only 44% of the votes. His challenger, Mike O'Malley, took 55% of voters, and since only Democratic candidates were running, O'Malley has won outright. A similar scene played out in the Windy City, where Chicago's voters, who just shut down a Donald Trump rally, they just ousted Cook County State's Attorney Anita Alvarez.
Right.
Yeah, she's the one who charged police officer Dante Servin with involuntary manslaughter rather than charging murder, which legal experts say was the appropriate charge in this case. This is an officer who decided to fire his gun into a crowd of people and wound up killing 22-year-old Rakia Boyd.
Right.
Alvarez is also the same prosecutor who it took longer than a year to decide to charge Officer Jason Van Dyke for the shooting of 17-year-old Laquan McDonald. The video of the shooting was released. Actually, let me be clear. The government was forced to release the video of the shooting that clearly showed Van Dyke shooting into the lying on the ground prone body of McDonald. So after, you know, the shutdowns and the protests and whatnot, it's very clear these protests are translating into ballot box wins for this Black Lives Matter movement. Mm-hmm. And the nation is watching. And so are the prosecutors, because forcing out these prosecutors who are refusing to charge cops criminally when they shoot and kill unarmed Black people, it's a big step toward changing the rules of policing, in which many places immunity is pretty much promised if the officer claims, "I was scared for my life. I had to shoot the unarmed Black person." You know, because now prosecutors know the voters are watching, and even more so, they're voting.
Right, so they can be scared for their career.
Exactly.
Right. Well, we are watching, too, you know, all these cases. So thank you, Jamila, for that report.
Thank you very much for having me.
And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, did you know that some women in Saudi Arabia need the permission of their sons to go out? Stay with us. That was Navasha Deya on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam. Dutch lawmakers voted this week to ban weapons exports to Saudi Arabia over the kingdom's violations of humanitarian law in Yemen, making the Netherlands the first country in the European Union, the EU, to follow through on a motion by the European Parliament in February. The landmark resolution approved on Tuesday asks the Dutch government to impose a full arms embargo on Saudi Arabia, including dual-use exports that could be used to violate human rights. The bill cites United Nations figures that Saudi-led troops have killed nearly 6,000 people in Yemen, half of them civilians. The ongoing practices of Saudi Arabia was the focus of a recent summit on Saudi Arabia here in D.C., sponsored by Code Pink. Last week, we heard the keynote address by author and activist Cridge Hedges, and this week, to honor Women's History Month, we'll hear remarks from Ebtihal Mubarak, a Saudi journalist, and Christine Beckerly of Human Rights Watch.
Saudi Arabia, where do I begin? It's complicated, the status of relationship of Saudi women and their government and country. It is hard to have your own country as your sole enemy. I recall reading a very expressive line opening the Human Rights Watch report years ago. It's called on Saudi women, called Perpetual Minors. It is an anonymous quote of one of the Saudi women that the Human Rights Watch researchers met. And it says, "How can I be proud of a country who's not proud of me?" That line, you know, it just it really sums up the relationship that the Saudi women feel towards their country. It is basically a gender apartheid. I said this when I was back in Saudi Arabia reporting. I said it in CNN. It upset officials back then, and I mean, reality should upset them. Basically, I mean, you wanted me to explain to you, to walk you through the life of Saudi women. Saudi women are highly educated, much more, I mean, a bit more educated than the men. There's a high rise of unemployment, basically because of bad planning of the government and also the sex segregation at workforce and all walks of life, and we're going to get to that later. Basically, if you are a Saudi woman who are born in a house that is in a household, in a family that's a little bit more open-minded, you can really get a lot of things done. But that's a privilege that the majority of women don't have. So it is basically up to your legal guardian to decide for you what to study, where to go, to travel or not, and there are very little even things in your life, like starting issuing an ID, or going to have an operation at the hospital even. I mean, the very big things are the really small things. You are totally dependent on your legal guardian. That could be your father, your husband, your brother, your cousin, your uncle, or even your son. But really, this is having all this authority in the legal male guardian, I mean, a male figure, in your life, I mean, the absence of law and accountability, it really turns the monster, really, in men. If you give so much power to anyone, so, I mean, all these terrible cases, I mean, the bad treatment of Saudi women is not because Saudi men are inheritedly, by DNA, are, you know, hate women. It's because they have all this power in their hands, and, you know, if you have that much power, there'll be an abuse of power. I'd like you also to know the Saudi women that want you to speak out and want your help, but they also, it's very important to mention, as the media mentioned clarified at the beginning of the conference, this is not about Islamophobia or victimizing certain groups or patronizing, you know, others. There has been a lot of work that Saudi women are doing on the ground, but it's incredibly hard and very, very difficult due to the ban of civil society in Saudi Arabia. Since the establishment of the country, there are no independent NGOs. There are no student clubs at the universities. We don't know each other to begin with, so we can collaborate and work on things that any regular civil society in any country would do.
So you'll hear much more, but we want to just have her set the context of the Saudi woman. Our next speaker is Christine Beckerly. She works in the Middle East and North Africa Division of Human Rights Watch, where she focuses on Saudi Arabia and women's rights. Prior to Human Rights Watch, she worked at UNRWA, the UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees in Amman, Jordan, on issues related to gender-based violence and international protection. She has worked for the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York, Human Rights Watch in Amman, and the Documentation Center of Cambodia in Phnom Penh. Christine holds a law degree from Yale and bachelor's from Harvard. She thinks that it was her love of literature, and pretty sure the fantasy novels she gobbled up as a kid with strong female heroines, to thank for the early development of her commitment to feminism and championing human rights. Again, you can follow her, and it's K_ and her last name. Feel free to tweet and to continue to follow her work. I'm Christine.
So first of all, thank you to Code Pink, and I'm really excited, second of all, to be on a panel with Ipti Hall, who has been sort of a good inspiration for me over the last few months. So basically, what I've been doing for the last 6 months or so is doing an update of the Perpetual Minors report that Ipti Hall just mentioned. So looking at the male guardianship system sort of in depth and trying to unpack, because I think a lot of people will say quite briefly, you know, the male guardianship system is the biggest impediment to women's rights in Saudi Arabia, but they won't do a deeper dive as to what that actually means to a host and a range of women's rights in the country and to, like, the very, as Ibtihal was mentioning, the very day-to-day things that it affects and impacts. So I was hoping to start off just with a quick vignette of what one of the women who I interviewed over the last couple of months said to me when talking about the male guardianship system. So this woman is 44 years old. She's a 23-year-old son. She has been a teacher for years, for decades. And we were talking about her difficulties with the male guardianship system. So I was asking her immediately, you know, who is your male guardian? And what she says to me is that she's been going through a process of transferring her guardianship from her father to her son because her father is very old and sick. And she says, my father is so old, and in every legal movement, I need a male, so I had to transfer the guardianship. I have a piece of paper that says my son, again, 23 years old, she's 44, is the legal guardian of me. It sounds stupid and silly, but it is the only way to make my every movement easier. She didn't go to court to transfer the guardianship. She sent her son and her ex-husband. And then she says, I should go to court, but it is strange because in my country, they don't think of women like a complete person, so they prefer to deal with men. It can mess with your head and the way you look at yourself. How do you respect yourself, or how can your family respect you if he's your legal guardian? It is hard. So, and I think the one sort of like message that I want to get across is a lot of the times when people talk about the male guardianship system, and particularly when members of the Saudi government talk about the male guardianship system, they'll blame the fact that it is continuing on Islam, society, culture. And I think that there are certain aspects of the male guardianship system, because it's not really a monolithic thing, right? It manifests itself in a variety of different practices, laws, regulations. So there are certain aspects of it that are informal and that are enforced by men or employers outside of the government's control. But there's other aspects of it that are very much government enforced. And the reason I want to emphasize that is because as soon as anybody says to you, you know, it's Islam, it's culture, it's society, well, then you say, but in this regulation, on this government website, you say explicitly that you require male guardianship for X. So, for example, everyone always talks about women's driving. But the imposition of restrictions on women's movement goes far beyond driving. So, for example, according to the Ministry of Interior, so this is formal government policy, a woman cannot apply for a passport, cannot renew a passport, and cannot travel abroad without a male guardian signing off. And that seems on its face to be absurd, but the problem is it's not just that she can't travel abroad without a male guardian's permission. It's that this gives men an incredible ability to sort of impose their will on women beyond this. So, for example, I've talked to women who have had male guardians condition their travel permission on women giving them part of their salary, on women promising to return at a certain time, and even on women dropping court cases against their male guardians. And that includes court cases for abuse. So I really want to emphasize, and this is one of the things that has been really one of my focuses over the last couple of months, and I'll stop here because we wanted to make this more of a conversation, is that what a lot of people will say when you talk to them is that the purpose of the male guardianship system is to protect women. And, I mean, that's problematic for a whole number of reasons. And you hear the same thing sort of across the globe, is that we're protecting women through these rules. And as a woman, I don't feel protected by them. But when you talk about abuse in Saudi Arabia, when you talk about a woman who is literally abused by her male guardian, you have situations where, and like, good on the government, they passed a law in 2013 to sort of criminalize domestic abuse and try and make it slightly better for women who are abused. And that's amazing. That's great. But the problem is what they didn't change is that women still have male guardians. Male guardians can still file claims against women for disobedience, which means that there are actual cases that we've covered where a woman files a claim against a guardian saying, he abuses me. He files a counterclaim against her saying she's been disobedient. And so then she goes to jail. And that's not a good thing. That's not a way to make it that women can be protected and can escape from abuse. And then the other sort of like last little nugget of information I want to add to that is that also means that when women go to prison, maybe for disobedience, so not like a terrible crime, just not listening to their father, or when women go to a shelter, again, for abuse, the shelter or the prison may require the woman's guardian to release her, which gets you in a situation where women can be stuck in prison for years because their male family members are refusing to release them. And so I do want to emphasize the government has done certain things to sort of like nip at the male guardianship system and change certain aspects of it, particularly in the right to work. But we're still in a situation where the very fact that male guardianship exists is a huge violation of human rights. So I just sort of want to emphasize that when people talk to you about it, when people sort of like question, well, you know, there's all these things in Saudi Arabian like religion and culture and whatever, just note and point out that there's actually certain things that the government could do tomorrow if they wanted to that would really, really help women's lives in a very concrete and direct way.
When I was back in Saudi Arabia, I covered the case of a forcefully divorced woman, a woman who has been married by the approval of her legal male guardian, at the time was her father. She's been married for years. She had children even. And at some point, her half-brothers, in other cases, you know, there are other cases like, you know, distant relatives, objected the marriage because they thought the husband is untribally fit to match to their, you know, status. And they actually filed a case at the court, local courts, and the judges ordered that the couple are to be divorced against their will, although they had children. And at the time I thought, you know, covering that story, like how strange it is, like it's like a one incident, it's an individual story. And you know what? I discovered that there are many stories across the country. That story was in a conservative, it was in the eastern province, and the family is a bit from the north, so it was mentioned, and it was at the north in the court, and it was there for like years. It went for years. The king had to, I mean, it went all the way to the king. The human rights organizations had, you know, statements and, you know, issued their concern. And at the end, you know, the couple were united, not because they should be united, because the husband had to make proof from a tribe leader that he's tribally fit to marry this woman.
Okay, yeah, so as always, Ifti Hall has said very many things that I agree with. But yeah, one of the things that I will say, and that has been sort of hard for me, is that some of the symbolic steps really, I mean, they are meaningful to people in a way. So, for example, I'm sure you all saw in the media, the Western press like really got into this. So in December 2015, women voted and ran as candidates for the first time for municipal council elections in Saudi Arabia. And sort of that always has to be qualified with these municipal councils don't have a lot of political power, to say the least. But that being said, women themselves in Saudi Arabia fought for the right to run and campaign in these elections for years. So for them, and like even talking to women who were candidates, campaign managers, or just voting in the elections, they were really excited. And it was a really exciting moment for all of them. Because I think what I have realized is that while the government is very good at sort of doing this window dressing and doing symbolic steps, at the same time, because women in Saudi Arabia really are fighting very hard for every inch they can gain, that like these little things are, you know, a big deal for them. And I think one of the things that was tough for me talking to people was that for the municipal council elections, the way it was covered mostly in the Western press was sort of this like grand victory and like, here we are, women have been emancipated, the end. Which is not the story that actually was playing out on the ground. Because, so for example, registering to vote, and I will continue harping on about the guardianship system because it's the thing that I'm obsessed with. So forgive me if you get bored. But anyways, what happened was, to register to vote, you needed to present proof of residence. And this, like, makes sense on its face, right? Like, they wanted to make sure that you were voting for the right municipal council. So, okay. But the problem is, in Saudi Arabia, many women, it's very, very difficult for them to rent or own property in their own name. It's much easier for a male to rent property. So that means that most leases have a male's name on the lease, and women just happen to live in that house. So that means that that document is in the male's control, i.e. the woman needs to ask that man for that document to register to vote. Second thing you needed to do is, okay, fine, so you're not on the lease, but you just need to prove a relationship with that man, no big deal. But the document that does that is this thing called a family card, which basically lists out, you know, I am Christine, I am married to X, we have these children. That document, the male holds. And so Again, women needed to ask men for the necessary documents to register to vote. And again, and not to harp on women driving, but women could not drive to the polling stations. So like there's a whole bunch of like logistical things that made it very, very difficult for women to register to vote. And one of the women we actually spoke with, who is divorced, her and her daughter, it took them 2 weeks literally running around to different government offices to try and register to vote. But they were very committed to it. They've been campaigning for it for years. So they did register and they did end up voting. And that's great. And then in the end, a number of women actually won seats, like defying expectations. So again, very small victory, but still a big, important victory. And then I don't know if any of you have been following, but so then the municipal councils met, and they met, the municipal council met in Jeddah, and the Jeddah municipal council had two women on it, so that's amazing. And the two women, sort of understandably, were trying to sit at the same table as their male counterparts. And some of their male counterparts decided that they could not sit at the same table as the women because this was against Sharia or it was inappropriate, and they sort of caused a big fuss and the meeting couldn't meet. And the women were insisting, we don't want to have to sit behind a partition. We just want to sit at the same table. And as Ibtihal mentioned, the Shura Council, which has had women on it since 2013, they sit in the same room as the men, which was sort of the female municipal council's argument. It's like a higher political body already does this, already has people in the same room. So why are we making this a problem? And so what you would hope is that the government would come down and say, no, okay, listen, men, just like sit in the same room as people. But instead what happened was a couple of weeks after this kerfuffle, the Ministry of Municipal Affairs passed regulations explicitly stating that women had to sit in a separate room and participate via video link. And okay, so maybe you would say, you know, Skype technology, it's amazing now, but it's not. Like, if you have two women on a council with 28 men and they're in a back room and they're having people come in to meet with the council and the women are not in the room and are participating over a video link that like might not be working, that's a big impediment to their ability to effectively participate on these municipal councils, which again don't have that much power to begin with. And so I was talking, and it was one of the saddest moments I've had, honestly, interviewing people, and some of them are very sad moments, but one of like the biggest women's rights activists that has been like an amazing sort of support and source of information is talking to me, and she goes, I don't even know if I'm going to vote for women in the next election because they've been completely marginalized, and like what are they going to do on these municipal councils? And so I think that's sort of like another thing that I want to get through, is that it's not that the government hasn't done anything for women, because that's not true. It's not the right narrative. They have done certain things, but certain things are certainly not enough. And what they undercut their own efficacy by not really pushing things forward.
I'd like to finish here by, I was asked to say what, can be done. One is to hold Saudi Arabia accountable for international treaties that they have signed and ratified. For example, the CEDAW Treaty. We have a women rights bill out there that the Saudi Arabian government have signed. So to hold them, you know, accountable for that. I'm not sure when is the next. Supposedly, every 4 years, each country should submit its report to the CEDAW Committee in Geneva. Not sure, maybe we could plan something for the next time that the Saudis go to Geneva and give their report. And by the way, the first time Saudi Arabia was in Geneva giving their report, that was 2006 or 2007, I think 2007, the Saudi woman activist submitted their report anonymously, the shadow report, because of fear of persecution. So that's one thing I'd like to mention too. Also, it is really worth noticing that this country, the United States of America, is in the company of countries like Iran and Somalia and Sudan, who did not ratify the CEDAW. So maybe you guys also can, it's collective work of pressuring governments to sign that treaty. One last thing I'd like to end up at, to finish up with, is really the frustration that we have from the coverage of Saudi in U.S. media. Like, I'd like you to challenge that. When you see a story that said small steps for Saudi women, like, no, what does that small steps mean? They need big steps. We need things to be implemented to make it look like, you know, there's always this story about this woman who thinks things are not so bad, but, you know, she wants small contained reform and she's okay generally with the big things, but the little things that, anyway, this narrative should always be challenged. Please write to whatever publications you read, to the editors, to the journalists, and Well, thank you for listening. Thank you, Code Pink, for organizing this amazing, wonderful conference. I hope it's an annual thing here. Thank you.
If you're just tuning in, this is Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on WPFW Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. And you're just listening to remarks from Ebdihal Mubarak, a Saudi journalist, and Christine Beckerly of Human Rights Watch at the recent Summit on Saudi Arabia sponsored by Code Pink here in the nation's capital. When we come back, the condition of our electoral system here in the U.S., there's talk of freedom of speech issues and proto-fascism. Stay with us.
Species, but I sing no victim song.
Well,
I am a woman, I am an artist, and I know where my voice belongs.
That was Diane Reeves on Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition on WPFW. I'm Esther Averam. Well, as we mentioned at the top of the hour, the U.S. presidential race continues to be the big story, with violence at Donald Trump rallies, the continued corporate media snub of Bernie Sanders, and a very seemingly superficial discussion about what is political freedom of speech and proto-fascism and fascism. And so with me this morning to discuss these matters is our prolific author and activist, Gerald Horn, professor of history and African-American studies at the University of Houston, and a frequent contributor on this show and across the Pacifica Network. Good morning, Gerald.
Good morning to you.
So after this last weekend in U.S. politics, talking about violence in St. Louis, and then in Chicago at Donald Trump rallies, then Donald Trump trumpeting this claim that he was denied his freedom of speech, and then we had this big win by him, by Hillary Clinton on Tuesday, and by Donald Trump on Tuesday. I think you said that this country is getting interesting, and so I wanted to ask you what you meant by that.
Well, what's happening in terms of the violence that's taking place at these Trump rallies in particular, that's in many ways a reflection of the fact that the United States is coming under increasing pressure abroad. You may have noticed the interview with President Barack Obama in the current issue of The Atlantic, conducted by journalist Jeffrey Goldberg, in which he criticized sharply British Prime Minister David Cameron, former French President Nicolas Sarkozy, the Saudi Arabian leadership, and many others. And it was quite extraordinary. And I think it's a reflection of the fact that the United States historically has been the guarantor of world imperialism, but that role no longer pays as many dividends as it once did in light of the rise of China. That is to say that the project of U.S. imperialism is coming under great pressure, and that's trickling down to the grassroots, particularly, I might say, the white grassroots, who are in open rebellion against the Republican Party establishment, of which they had had a close relationship heretofore, and this is leading to a very severe electoral crisis in the first place.
So, you know, for the F-word series that we've been doing for more than a year now, we use this quote by George Jackson that fascism is the complete control of the state by monopoly capital, and that it's the last stage of capitalism in the heart of the U.S. imperial center, where the relationship between the state and corporation becomes indiscernible. And I'm wondering how this relates to having a true corporatist, an actual millionaire or billionaire like Trump, actually running for president. You know, there. Well, let me just stop there. How the hell does that relate to him being in this race, being on the one hand this corporatist and this millionaire, billionaire, but on the other hand appealing to all these, working class voters?
Well, as I've said before, and I'll say it again, obviously you, Esther, were in the vanguard in terms of ringing the bell, and trying to warn us against creeping fascism. Now that idea has crept into the mainstream. It's almost a staple of Washington Post columnists nowadays. And the fact that Donald Trump, a billionaire, is leading a revolt of white working class people is symptomatic of what you've been talking about. That is to say, I believe, at least I would like to believe, that the white working class that is supporting Donald Trump, they're doing it because they're concerned about their deteriorating life chances. But I'm afraid that what's happening is that forces that are being unleashed will not be controllable either by the base of the Donald Trump coalition or Donald Trump himself, and that spells dire prospects for the rest of us.
So in addition to the him drawing these kind of a white working class following, I've been also reading a number of pieces that kind of really drilling down a little further into this whole comparing him to a fascist. Two good pieces, one I think in Salon, one in Daily Coast, talking about really the comparison to Mussolini and how Mussolini in the beginning attacked very marginalized groups like Donald Trump is marginalizing Muslims, then Mexicans, and people that he wants to refer to as all ISIS, immigrants. And how Mussolini then moved on to bash communists, socialists, and then eventually anyone who was a Democrat and who believed in democratic rights. So there seems to be a comparison that a lot of people who are historians and scholars are making between Trump and Mussolini. What are your thoughts?
Well, I think those comparisons need to be made. Recall also that Benito Mussolini, that the centerpiece of this leader of fascism in Italy in the 1920s and 1930s and early 1940s, the centerpiece was the attack on independent Ethiopia in the mid-1930s. That is to say, a naked and rank anti-African racism was a central aspect of the fascist agenda. And when one looks at the Trump phenomenon and the attack on people of Mexican origin, the attempt to forestall the arrival of Muslims on these shores, and also singling out China and even the U.S. ally Japan for excoriation in terms of talking about trade deals, this is the kind of racism that oftentimes lubricates the path for a sharp shift to the right, a further shift to the right, I might say, and that seems to be what Donald Trump is portending.
You know, I meant to offer callers the opportunity to call in if you would like to join the discussion. We don't have a lot of time, but if you have a comment on our topic, you can call in at 202-588-0893 as I continue my conversation with Gerald Horn. I was really kind of annoyed, you know, as a journalist about this whole trumpeting of the idea of Donald Trump being denied his freedom of speech. I felt that he went into a community that was diverse, that was filled with the very types of people he has been attacking. And then when protesters come out and they have a right to protest, he says that he was denied his freedom of speech, but he's the one who called off the rally. I've just been really kind of annoyed by this double speak and also the coverage of the media of it with very little sophistication.
Well, it's not only that, it's the fact that Donald J. Trump has received a tidal wave of free media. You may recall that just tonight,
I'm kind of losing you a little bit. I don't know if you want to sit closer to the microphone. Did we lose you?
Okay, is that better?
It's still kind of going out a little bit. Is the connection? Say something again. Let me see if I can hear you.
Call me on my telephone.
Okay, we'll call you back. Okay, so did we have someone on the phone, Mike? Yeah. Okay, so the two pieces that I wanted to draw your attention to, everybody listening, that There's a piece in Salon titled "Trump's Not Hitler, He's Mussolini: How GOP Anti-Intellectualism Created a Modern Fascist Movement in America," and it's by Feja Burek, and that is a good piece that you might want to check out. And okay, we have Gerald back now.
Yes.
Okay, great. All right. So yeah, sorry, we tried the Skype, but it didn't. It failed us. So so anyway, you were talking about this whole freedom of speech issue.
Well, you may recall that just the other night, when the results were announced of the second Super Tuesday, that Bernie Sanders gave a stem-winding address for an hour in Phoenix, and yet rather than cover this address, as is typical, the major cable channels, including, if I'm not mistaken, MSNBC, which sees itself as the Democratic Party organ, preferred to not only broadcast every remark made by Donald J. Trump, but even having these bulletins running underneath the screen before he arrived saying, "Wait a minute, Donald Trump is coming." He's coming
exactly.
Soon.
We talked about shortly. That earlier in the show. Yeah. And we actually ran a little blurb from the Bernie Sanders speech, and I think two blurbs during this show today. So yes, it was very annoying. It was one of those moments when you're yelling at the TV. But I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Where you had a longer thought.
But I think the larger point, obviously, is that what has helped to propel Donald J. Trump is this free media. And it's not only the free media, it also reflects the moral decadence of the United States, because one of the reasons that he gets free media, not only because he's a billionaire and leans to the right, but also because he's so vulgar, which dovetails, I'm afraid, with the cultural predicates of cable television nowadays, which of course prompted Marco Rubio himself to go into the gutter and trying to attack Donald J. Trump, and he found that he couldn't do it as well and therefore had to drop out.
You know, I've also seen some discussions that want to make comparisons to, particularly with what happened in Chicago, and they want to really kind of discuss whether these were similar to clashes that happened just even in this country in the, I guess, the 20s and 30s between fascists and socialists and communists, when there was a real sense of a class war going on and like who would win the day in terms of the direction of the country. Do you agree with that?
Well, I think that those sorts of comparisons need to be made. I mean, certainly, I'm afraid to say that we have only begun to see the beginning of those kinds of clashes. I think that Donald Trump is the odds-on favorite to get the Republican Party nomination in Cleveland. Already, he's warned of riots, his word, not mine, if he does not get the nomination. And as well, there have already been invocations of Chicago 1968, recall the Democratic Party convention then, when there was blood literally flowing in the streets. Right. I'm afraid that we're in for a hot summer.
I do recall in terms of not only that clash, but some other clashes that happened in other cities that didn't get as much press. I saw a Trump supporter tell some Black Lives Matter movement activists to go back to Africa. The Black Lives Matter activists told the verse to go back to Europe, and you know, there was profanity, there was, you know, there were, you know, fists flying. There was also a snippet of one Trump supporter yelling at a, I think it was a mixed group that must have included some Jewish people, him telling them to go back to Auschwitz. So there was really just a lot of wilding out at these events that kind of support what you're saying. But anyway, we're going to definitely keep an eye on this and continue to talk to Gerald Horn about it. Thank you for joining me today, Gerald.
Thank you for inviting me.
So, yeah, we're running out of time. So that'll do it for us on Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I'm Esther Averam, and thanks again to my special guests, author and activist Gerald Horn, and also thanks to Jamila Bay, Chantel James, Lydia Curtis, and my extraordinary engineer, Mike Nasella. for helping with today's show. And thank you so much for listening and calling in. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all of our shows and our past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter pages at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Krista Property on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice out there. Peace. Thank you.